whatever you're doing. My name is Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. So I'm in a trap I can't spring. I had this physical allergy that when I start to drink, I'm compelled to drink to the wall, and I destroy myself, and I crash and burn eventually, and enter into a state of abstinence, and I get sick of spirit, sick of heart, and abstinence kind of wears on me until I can't take it anymore, and I eventually seek relief. And if I can't find relief in money or sex or stuff, the shine of that stuff wears off, and I'll seek the relief again in alcohol or combinations, alcohol and drugs, and I crash and burn again, and just it's back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And through all of that came to AA meetings. I remember sitting in meetings feeling like I was dying with this big secret. And the big secret was I was a phony member of AA. Big secret is I'd go to discussion meetings and the subject was gratitude, and I'd make a little intellectual list of everything I was grateful for and tell you how grateful I am. And go back to the halfway house and wished I were dead. Until I got to a place where I turned the corner, where the thing that happened to me that pushed me out of the group that would not or could not completely give themselves to the simple program into the group that would. And I'll tell you a little story, something that happened to me before I got sober. Right before, I had a period of abstinence of a lot of months for me in a halfway house, and I drank again because I couldn't take it. I was just up to here with the boredom and the loneliness of abstinence, and I drank again, and on that drunk, I got a felony hit and run DUI and a stolen car. It wasn't really a stolen car. I borrowed it, but that's, you know, humorless people. And I ended up in a county jail cell, and I was facing 2 years in a state penitentiary. And a guy that I knew from the halfway house, who was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sober probably 10 years, he used to come into the halfway house I was in when I started the run with the AA group and bring meetings in there, came into the county jail. And he was part of the AA group that came into the county jail. And his name was Woody, and I didn't want to see Woody. You know, when you're like that, I don't want to see anybody when I'm like that, because I've trashed my life again. I've lost my place to live. I've lost all my clothes again. I have nothing. You know, I'm back to zero on the streets, and I'm in jail, going to go do 2 years in a state penitentiary. And here comes Woody. And Woody is one of those grateful, enthusiastic, funny guys that laughs a lot. I mean, he's not the kind of guy you want to see when you're like that. You know what I mean? He's not really. I think I'd rather have a root canal than face Woody. But here he comes. And so I go into my act. I go in, I say, oh, Woody, how you doing? He says, makes some wise remark like, doesn't look like you had much fun on this run, and or something, you know, like that. And I went into my spiel, and my spiel is, oh, I'm so sorry I let you guys down. And, you know, I'm going to get in a good halfway house, not like that one that took advantage of me, but in a good one, you know, where they really understand a guy like me, and I'm going to get a good job, and maybe I'm going to go back to school, and I'm going to go back to some of your meetings, and I'll work your stairs, and I'll do all that stuff. Woody looked at me, and he really hurt my feet. He said, kid, who are you kidding? You're not done. He says, you're not done. He says, you haven't hit a bottom yet. You haven't surrendered. You're not done. And I didn't say nothing to him because I don't like confrontation. But I thought at him. You ever think at people? You know? And I'm screaming at him in my head. Who the hell are you to tell me I ain't done? You don't know nothing about me, you and your Cadillac and your nice home. You don't know nothing. I've lost everything. What do you mean I'm not done? I haven't lost enough. Haven't, sir. What are you talking about? What's there? I got nothing left to lose. I've lost everything. I'm going to prison. There's no, when they gave me the phone call, when they arrested me, there was not a person on the face of the earth to call. There's nothing left of me. What are you talking about? I haven't lost. There's nothing left to lose. And Woody was right. That was not my last drunk, and I hadn't surrendered, and I hadn't lost the one thing. The one thing. And I was sober a number of years before I got it. I understood what had happened to me. And guys, lose that one thing, living in million-dollar homes with wives and kids and have never been to jail. They lose the thing that keeps you from getting sober, and they come to AA and they get sober and their life is wonderful. And then there are other guys that never lose it. They go down, they lay in the gutter, they die in their own, they drown in their own vomit when they throw up and they, when they're passed out. Or they hang themselves in county jails, or they drive their motorcycles into bridge abutments, or they never lose it. And it's not the house, and it's not the job. It's not the self-respect. I mean, God, I left that in the dust years before I got sober. The one thing that I couldn't give up that kept me from getting everything that you had was my self-reliance, my judgment. And Woody knew that. He looked at me and he heard my little plans and designs, and he saw me at the steering wheel of my life once again, telling him what I'm going to do. I couldn't see that. And he knew by looking at me that I wasn't going to make it, because I was still running the show. I'm the kind of guy that I can go on a run and alcohol take everything away from me. I get sober, come back to AA, and the first thing I get back is my damn opinion. And my opinion and my judgment is what kept me at the helm of my own life. At the helm. And I couldn't see it. You know, you could have seen it. My folks could see it. The people in AA can see it. Anybody who watched me for any period of time at the end, it didn't take a rocket scientist to look at me and what's happening in my life and easily come to the conclusion that whoever's running this guy's life is out to kill him. But it doesn't look that way in here, really, because I'm just trying to make it better. I'm just trying to get along. I'm just trying to help myself. And I can't connect the dots that I'm in this spot because I am at the helm of my life. I can't get it. Woody saw it the minute he heard me talk. And what is it that brought me to the point of surrender? It wasn't the facing the 2 years in prison. I came off my last run. A judge had sentenced me to 2 years in a state penitentiary, cut me a break, put me into a long-term, I call it a treatment center. It really wasn't. It was a skid row place. It was the bottom of the food chain for treatment. It was a place that housed about 200 low, low bottom alcoholics. It told me if I stayed in there for a year, got good UAs, good PO report, made the restitution, that I was supposed to come back in front of him and maybe we wouldn't have to do the 2 years. But if he said, I remember him saying to me, kid, he says, you go out, you do this again, you go out, you don't fulfill these requirements, you're gone. And I couldn't fill the requirements because I don't have the power. I don't have the power, even when I've made up my mind that I'll never drink again. My best effort and all my power will just put it off for a while. That's all. I can stretch it out. Months. Maybe under the right circumstances, if I had enough props in my life, financially and emotionally, maybe I could have stretched it out to a couple years. Who knows? But I'm the alcoholic that with untreated alcoholism, the drink's coming. It's coming. I can throw a lot of stuff to slow it down. Get a new relationship. Slow it down a little bit. It's still coming. Go get a new job. Buy a Harley. Get a sports car. Move. Slows it down. but it doesn't change the reality that it's coming. Because I haven't gotten free. I don't have the power. Lack of power is my dilemma. And the thing that brought me to the point of surrender was nothing I ever would have imagined. If you would have told me that this was going to happen to me, I wouldn't have understood what you were saying. I wouldn't have got it until it happened to me. And what had happened to me is exactly what it talks about on page 151 and 152. I think of these two paragraphs as the description of the entrance to Alcoholics Anonymous, the entrance to, as Bill says so poetically, to being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, into the world of the spirit. And this is the thing that brought me to the threshold of that world of the spirit. The bottom of page 151, it says, "Now and then a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, 'I don't miss it at all, feel better, work better, having a better time.' As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself inwardly, secretly. He would give anything to take a half dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. Really, not really happy about it. Feels like he's doing time. He cannot picture life without alcohol." And that's what all my experiences with abstinence were like that. You know, I would say this stuff. I never read this part of the book, but I would almost parrot it. I would say, someone would ask me, "How you doing?" "Oh, I'm doing great. Work better, feel better, having a better time." Well, or I'd just say, "Oh, I'm just so grateful to be sober." You know, I guess I thought maybe if I said that enough, it would eventually come true or something. I don't. But you know what always happened is that I'd feel phony. I'd go back to my bunk in the halfway house and feel like, you know, God, I'd feel awful. Because my head would spin and I'd be depressed and I, you know, lonely. I can't imagine life without alcohol. And I eventually try the old game again because I'm not happy about my sobriety, really. Not really. I have not had a spiritual experience. There's nothing different about my... There's nothing that is awoken in me. Really, not in here. Not really. I'm just the same. I'm the guy, I'm Bob not drinking. I'm Bob not drinking. Bob doesn't do well not drinking. Bob not drinks for a while, and he remembers why drinking was a good idea. I can't picture life without alcohol. And then here's exactly what happened to me. It says, someday, and this happened to me on my last run. I remember the moment. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place, which I think is the entrance to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says he will wish for the end. That's what brought me to the bridge in 1978, trying to get up enough courage to take my own life. I finally understood that the party was over. I finally got it that no matter what I drink or take or smoke, that I cannot and never will be again able to jumpstart the party and get back to the good old days. That it's a memory. It's just a memory. And there's no more fun in it. And yet the hopelessness about it is the truth. I got it finally. I knew I can't live without it. I know that there's something about me that I do not have what it takes to live in this world and be okay without something to change the way I feel. I don't have it. I don't know why I don't have it. I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know that it's alcoholism. It's a spiritual malady. I don't know that that's what it is. I just know that I can't live with it and I can't live without it. And that brought me to a place that says we'll know loneliness such as few do. When you finally get it that the party's over, when you finally get it that now you're the guy drinking yourself to oblivion, watching everybody else drink and have a good time, and you know you're never going to be like that again. That is loneliness. That it doesn't externalize you anymore, and it never will. It's never going to let you come out and play again. That you're never going to be like you used to be. No wonder guys like me start thinking about offing themselves. Once you get to a place where you get it, that drinking sucks and not drinking sucks, suicide looks like a good deal to a guy like me. And that's what took me to the jumping off place until I wished for the end. And coming off that run, something had changed. I didn't know that what it was surrender. I didn't know that I'd even had that experience. But I'll tell you what happened. I sat in the detox, and members of Alcoholics Anonymous came into the meetings in there, as they had done in every institution I'd ever been in. And for the first time in 7 years, sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing in me that always picks apart what you say and tries to pigeonhole you and say, oh, he's a phony, and he's a born again, and he's this, and she's that, you know, so I don't have to listen to you. It stopped. And I found myself sitting in those meetings, and people would share, and I sat there and I'd nod my head. And I'd think, oh my God, I'm like that. I felt like that. I drank like that. I failed like that. And I started to connect. When I was early in sobriety, a guy gave me a box of books, and he gave me clothes. Because, you know, I came out, I had nothing. And in this, I like to read that's how I do time. And I'm reading this book, and it's not a self-help book, and it's not a book about alcoholism, it's just a novel. But there was a passage in that book that blew my mind. And it showed me, it gave me greater insight into what had happened to me and my disease of alcoholism than anything I'd heard in AA. And what the book was, this passage was about these scientists that were doing experiments on the human brain. And they found that in the human brain was a little part that in the book they called it the pleasure center. It's the part of the brain that allows you to experience the euphoria from alcohol and also other drugs. It's where you get high. So these scientists took these laboratory rats and they put two tiny wire filaments into the pleasure center of the rat's brain. And they would pass a mild, almost undetectable electric charge through those wires just to stimulate the pleasure center in the brain. What would happen is the rat would get loaded, get high. So what they did is they hooked up the juice that went through the wires to a pedal in the rat's cage, and the rat would learn he could hit the pedal and get high. So the rat would just go over and lay on that goddamn pedal. I mean, he doesn't drink water, he doesn't eat, he doesn't have sex, nothing. He's just partying, hitting that pedal. And the rat would, some of these rats would hit that pedal until they die. Usually of dehydration, because they wouldn't even drink water or they wouldn't eat, they wouldn't do nothing, just hit the pedal. And these scientists, they'd wait till a rat is almost dead. And they'd come along and they'd turn the juice off. Now the rat goes back and he hits the pedal and nothing happens. And he hits it again and nothing happens. And again and again and again and again. And finally, after many, many futile, vain attempts to turn the juice back on and failing, he finally gets it that the party's over. And instead of being able to just go back to being a rat, the rat would curl up on the floor of the cage and lay there to die. Because without the juice, there's nothing to live for. In 1978, I was broken. My surrender was because I was like that rat. My surrender was that I couldn't live with it. And I can't live without it. And I don't have the balls to kill myself. And there was absolutely no options. And in a moment of abject hopelessness and a detox, I did something that a guy like me would never, ever do. a woman that worked there had told me about a prayer on page 63 of the big book. And I'm getting ready to be checked out of there. And I know I'm going to drink again. And I know it's going to kill. I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. And I opened this big book that they'd given me. And I turned to page 63. And I started reading this prayer. And I don't understand it. And I don't even believe in God. But there's a line in the middle of the prayer that says, "Relieve me of the bondage of self." And I'm in this hospital, sitting on this hospital bed reading that. And I threw the book across the room and I started sobbing. And I fell down on my knees. And from the bottom of my being, I begged something I didn't even believe in for help. Because when I read the line, "Relieve me of the bondage of self," I knew the truth that I'm going to drink again and I'm probably going to die and my life is going to be this way because of me and I can't get away from me. I don't know how to. By this time, I've spent years in therapy. I've tried every type of medication. I've done everything I could do and it's still there I am. And there was a hopelessness about that that drove me to that point of surrender. And I had I don't know what it was. I could have been DTs. I had an experience not like Bill Wilson, but I'll tell you what, after the sobbing all of a sudden went away, and I remember being there on the floor of that hospital room with on my knees and having this sense come over me that had no logical place to come from. And the sense was that I was going to be all right and I needed to go to AA. And I don't know where that came from. And I started going to the meetings in that detox and I started not identifying with the people there. And I got a sponsor and I got out of there and I went to 15 meetings a week. And I still go to 10. I got out of the group that could not or would not completely give themselves to this simple program. And I got into the group that did. And I've never looked back. And my life has changed as a result of it. And I'll tell you something, if you're new here, that I didn't understand for a lot of years. And I've come to believe this with everything in me, that I think the whole purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, the whole purpose of the meetings and sponsorship and the 12 steps and helping others is designed to only do one thing and one thing only. And it's not to get you to quit drinking. If you want to quit drinking, punch a cop. You'll quit for a while. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is to do one thing, and that's to turn the juice back on. So when I get up in the morning, I can come out and play like I could only ever come out and play after 5 shots of Jack Daniels. So that I can integrate myself into society and with people and be a part of the way I only ever could do in the early days of my drinking when alcohol still worked for me. The big promise of the 12 steps is having had a spiritual awakening as the, meaning only, the only result of these steps. That the promise of Alcoholics Anonymous in the process that we're going to talk about this weekend is designed to do one thing and one thing only, is to awaken my spirit. And isn't that what alcohol did for me? I don't know about you guys, but I could walk into a bar feeling like I'm dead in here. And have 5 shots of tequila would awaken me to life. And if I don't find a way to do that, to get back in that zone, and you know what that zone's like. If you ever been in the zone in early drinking, man, where you can't miss? Shoot pool better than you can ever shoot pool. Dance better than you can ever dance. Talk to people. You got to get back to awakening that thing in you that alcohol at one time awoken. And that's what the 12 steps are designed to do. The great psychiatrist, Carl Jung, who was the founder of Jungian psychiatry, said in a letter to Bill Wilson, that he always suspected when he treated Roland Hazard and others, attempted to treat alcoholics, that he always suspected that the alcoholic's thirst for spirits was secretly a thirst for the spirit. It was that the alcoholic was thirsty because he was disconnected from his own spirit. And alcohol gave me the illusion of being, it was really a spiritual experience, really, by every definition of a spiritual experience. Carl Jung told Roland Hazard, who told Abby Thatcher, who told Bill Wilson about this, about what Carl Jung told him. Carl Jung, as Roland Hazard, who came from one of the wealthiest families on the face of the earth, in Switzerland, in his private clinic, he told Roland Hazard, "You're going to die. There's nothing we can do for you." And Roland begged him. He said, "Isn't there anything, Doc? Isn't there any exceptions?" And Carl Jung told Roland, he said, "Well, there is some phenomenons that occur. They've occurred throughout history. We don't understand them. I in my therapy, I was hoping to duplicate some similar experience for you, but it's never been effective in chronic alcoholics of your type. But there are people who have these conversion experiences throughout history. They're rare. Once in a while, someone will have a born again conversion." He said, "It's not really religious because it happens in every single, it'll happen in to Buddhists as much as Christians. And it happens every once in a while." And Roland thought that, "Well, maybe I can go back to my church." And Carl said, "I don't think that's it. I think it's an inside job." And Roland Hazard came back and he threw himself in the Oxford group. And the myth was in AA for years that he never drank again, which is not true. There's a biography out of Roland Hazard where they've documented him in and out of many sanitariums from the time he joined the Oxford group, and documented him visiting the 24th Street Club in New York, but he could never go to a meeting and join AA. And as a result, he never did stay sober. But he gave that information to a guy named Abby Thatcher, who gave the information to Bill Wilson. And all as and one more piece of the puzzle fell together that allowed us to all be here. When Bill Wilson was in Towns Hospital in December of 1934, Bill Wilson had a spiritual experience, possibly more powerful, but not too unlike the one that I had, that people have throughout history, these born-again experiences. And he said to Dr. Silkworth, he told him what had happened, and Silkworth could have shot him down. Silkworth said, "Bill, it's DTs." He never said that. He said to him, "I don't know what happened to you, but hang on to it. You look different. Something looks different about you." And Bill hung on to it. And Bill got hope. And he realized that something in here was different with him. That there had been a rearrangement of his emotions and perception in life. And he started to get some hope that maybe he'd found it. And he was given a copy of a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience. And I've read that book. I have a copy of it at home. It's a hard read. It's written by a guy named William James. And William James is credited to be the founder of modern psychology as opposed to psychiatry. And William James did something in The Varieties of Religious Experience that I don't think had ever been done to the degree he did it. Is he chronicalized religious conversion surrender experiences. From a scientific point of view. And he found that these conversion experiences that alter people's lives, that cause huge displacements emotionally within the person, have two things in common. First thing they all have in common is that they never happen to you when you're on a roll. You know what I'm saying? They never happen to you when you hit the mega bucks and you're with the three showgirls. I mean, it never happens that you never get to where it's going your way and you go, "Oh, it's time to find God now." Never happens. It always happens when you're broken. And then the second thing that William James noticed that they had inevitably and invariably in these experiences, not always, but frequently, is that they were transitory. Which means that they don't last. And we all know that. if this is a typical gathering of Alcoholics Anonymous, there are probably people in here that have had a born-again experience and drank again. That alcoholics of our type have been having those experiences for years, and there's something about them that the shine wears off of. The impact of them dissipates and evaporates in time until the emotional rearrangement that had happened as a result of the surrender wears off, and we revert slowly back to being the exact same way we were. And that has been happening since the beginning of time. And Bill Wilson read that, and for the first, and all of a sudden his hope that he'd arrived, that he was cured, that he was fixed, that God's grace had fixed him, dissipated. And out of that came the intuitive thought that I think is why we're here, is that maybe if I can do two things, if I can align myself with people who are trying to grow spiritually, and probably more importantly, if I can devote the rest of my life to helping people just like me, that maybe I can keep this alive. And that was the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have found this is the first time in human history that we have been given a process that's designed not to create a conversion experience. Your own pain can do that. It's to maintain it. Alcoholics have been dying for centuries because they, even if they can get it, they can't hold on to it. And it's the first thing that's been designed that allows us to keep that going in our lives and keep it vital. So we're going to start talking a little bit about step two. For those of you that are a little on the muscle about spiritual terms, as I was. A lot of us have had our fill of religion and failed. It doesn't mean that the religion was wrong. We just had a bad experience. We asked religion to do something it was never designed to do. There's a term in it, there's a line in We Agnostics that asks us to do something that none of us have ever tried to do. It says, do not let these terms, such as spiritual experience and God, etc., deter you from honestly asking yourself the most important question you'll ever ask yourself. What do they mean to you? It's really your deal. It's not the ministers. It's not the Bibles. It has to be in here. It's an inside job. What's this stuff really mean to you? And I'll tell you the beginning for me. I balked at the idea of alcoholism being a spiritual illness. I balked at the whole thing. I balked at religion. I had a bad experience. I had my fill with religion as a kid. I developed a lot of prejudices about religion, about God, to the point where I fancied myself an atheist, even though I don't know that anybody really is an atheist. I think I was a wannabe atheist. And I think I was a wannabe atheist because I'd come to the conclusion that God existed to judge me, and that if there is a God, I am probably in a lot of trouble. Right? But nobody's really an atheist, because in the human heart is the knowledge and the connection with the rest of the universe. But it said, what do these things real honestly mean to you? And so what was my first breakthrough, I guess, in this is that I started to realize that for me, when I drank alcohol, it vitalized my spirit. And when I stopped drinking alcohol, my spirit got sick. And I went back to drinking alcohol because it was medicine for something in here that was above and beyond mental or physical or emotional. There was something right in here that got didn't get do too well, that needed medication. On page 25, talks about a couple things that really brought me to AA and brought me to the table. And in a sense was my first awakening of sorts. The first paragraph, the fourth line down, it says, "We saw that it really worked in others." My first really awakening was that I saw that it worked in a guy that I knew. Now, I came to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for years and listened to your testimonies about how it changed your life, and it meant nothing to me. Because there's something about me that separates me from you, and you're those people. You know what I mean? You're them. It doesn't mean nothing to me. That's those AA people. I don't even listen. But I was in a halfway house with a guy who was exactly like me. We were running partners. And this guy had been on the streets with me. He drank like I drank. He did a lot of the same drugs I did. He did a lot of the same stuff. He felt and thought the way I did. And we were running partners. And we were both sober a number of months in this halfway house. And they'd make us go to AA meetings. So we went to AA meetings. We'd sit in the back of the room and just judge everybody in AA. To judge properly, you need a partner. And we'd just be back there. Just no respect for AA. We'd just be back there bad rapping, like, listen to this phony guy. I remember one, and we're both on marijuana maintenance, right? I remember we'd smoke pot and go in to the meeting and go, "Wow, man, did you hear what that guy said?" We're at this one meeting, and we were both offended by talk about God. It just made us both of us uncomfortable because where we came from and our fears and prejudices about God. And we're at this one particularly spiritual meeting where there's a lot of God talk. And I remember after the meeting we're saying, you know, if we could get enough money, we'll get a lot of LSD and we'll put it in their coffee. Let's see how spiritual those AA people are, right? Thank God that I never did that. That would have been a hard amends to make. Oh, my God. Oh, geez. What happened is I drank again. And before he did. And I got thrown out of the halfway house. And I'm living in this abandoned building that had been sort of semi-burnt out. I'm sleeping on the ground in there. I pass out. I go out and I hustle money to get cheap wine. I go back there. I pass out. I come down to the halfway house during the day. And I stand on the corner because they wouldn't let me on property. I would stand on the corner and I would wait for the guys to come out on their way to the laundromat, on their way to work. And I would panhandle nickels and dimes from them to support my wine habit. And one day I'm down there and I'm dirty. I have hair down to about here and it's matted. And I get this long ZZ Top kind of beard, you know, that's got stuff in it, you know, and right, little twigs and things. It's that Entish Lord of the Rings look, you know. And I'm down there, and I'm rummy, and I'm bloated, and I'm not eating. I'm emaciated and bloated at the same time, right? And puffy red eyes, and I'm pathetic, and I stink. And here comes my running partner, and he sees me, and he gives me that look that I think most human beings will go through a whole lifetime and never see that look on a person's face that cared about them. It's that look that's kind of a cross between pity and contempt. And he gave me that look and he gave me a couple dollars and I shuffled off to the state store and got another jug of wine and went to the park to blot out the madness. And him seeing me like that shocked him, did something to him. And he got off the marijuana maintenance. He changed his sobriety date. He went and got a sponsor. He got this guy that we hated. It was hideous. It was one of those fanatic AA guy, preachy, do-gooder, you know, one of those guys. He got one of those guys as a sponsor, unbeknownst to me. And he joins AA, starts working the steps and doing all this stuff. Many months later, I'm in another institution, right? And here come the AA group. Here come the AA people. And he's one of them. And he drove there in his car that was licensed and insured. And he's got two newcomers with him that he's trying to help. And I'm watching him at the coffee pot at the back of the meeting laughing and making fun of these guys, and they're kidding around and joking, and he's got that thing in his eyes. And he was talking, I overheard him talking about getting married and him and his fiance buying a house and about this job and how he got promoted. And he was different. Something had happened to him. And I could not discount him. I could discount you as you're them. But this guy I knew was like me. And I saw for the first time that it really not only worked in others, it worked at someone that was just like me. And then it says, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we'd been living it. And I believed that before I ever believed in God, before I ever believed in the steps, before I ever believed in AA. I believed in the hopelessness and futility of my life as I'd been living it. I couldn't go on no more, and I couldn't stop from going on. I was hopeless. And it says, when therefore we were approached, as I was in that detox in 1978, by those in whom the problem had been solved. You guys in AA, as you came into the detox the last time, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools. There was nothing left. If I'd have had another idea, if I'd have had a plan, if I'd have had some hope, if I'd have had any bit of opinion, self-reliance, judgment, anything left, I would not have been at the place where there was nothing left, because I'd have still had something left. I got to the place there was nothing left. I was at the very end of my rope. There was nothing left but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools that you had been laying at my feet for 7 years, and I've been kicking it out of the way because I got an opinion about what you're laying there. And it's opinion. It's a valid opinion, really. If you ever sat in the bottom of your life when you've just trashed it and you ask somebody for help, and you think you're going to jail, and you don't know what's happening, and you've lost your, and you have no friends, and you feel awful, and you've trashed your life, and you're broke and homeless, and you don't know what to do, and you ask somebody in AA, and he says, "Well, we got these steps." Do you ever look at the steps when you're like that? It's like, well, what else you got? I might do that crap. Hey, I might join a gym too, but I got problems here. I still had an opinion and a judgment. You were laying this simple kit of spiritual tools at my feet, and I was still following my own direction of what I needed, what I believed I had to have. I was pursuing what I needed to fix me, and I was getting the results. Not this time. This time when people in AA said, come with us, you know what I said? Yes. Go over here? Yes. Turn yourself into the cops? Well, wait a minute. And I said yes. And all the things they told me to do, I just started saying yes. And I think God implanted into my consciousness a phrase that went through my mind the first year I was sober over and over again, probably saved my life. When people in AA would tell me to do something I did not want to do, the line would go through my head, what do you got to lose? And I never had an answer to that. I had nothing to lose. So I just do it. And little did I know that I was actually acting like someone who had completely given themselves to this simple program, and I didn't know I was doing that. As I started to work the steps, I did it because you told me to do it. I didn't do it believing that it was going to change me. I didn't do it thinking that 20 years later you're going to have the life that's beyond your wildest dreams. I didn't do it thinking any of that. I didn't even do it thinking my life was going to change. I just did it because I had nowhere else to go and nothing left. and I was with you, and this is where I needed to be, and you told me to do something, and I did it. That was it. Little did I know that you guys were encouraging me to take actions that were going to repair and heal and awaken and vitalize my spirit, that I could become the guy that's in the zone. And I tell you, when you're in the zone, you can't miss. You are protected. You can't miss because you're directed. And if I can stay in the zone, my life stays good. But I don't know what it is about me. I can be in the zone. Things are going really good. God's grace is in my life. And this is so good that I just have this itch to improve it. I don't know what it is about me that does that. You know, I just want to get in there. And then I'm calling my sponsor frantically a week later. I don't know why I do that. That's my nature. I was 18, 20 years sober before I understood why in the book it says we must constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. Why does it say constantly? You know why it says constantly? Because I am constantly trying to run the show. That's why I have to constantly remind myself I'm not running the show. If it was not my inclination to constantly try to run the show, I would not have to constantly remind myself that I'm no longer running the show. I would just not run the show and go with the flow. But there's that thing in me that just, I have that kind of consciousness, things are going good, and just get in that frame of mind, we start noticing things. Things that need your attention. They're not really problems yet, but you can see how they could be. And I'm real good at solving problems that haven't occurred yet. I'm real good at that. It's got a nature to me to do that. That's why I have a sponsor. I tell the guys I sponsor, if you get a good idea, call me. If you get a great idea, come and see me. I will enjoy your idea. That takes us up to We Agnostics. How long are we going? Till 9? Is that right?
I don't know about
it. Was it till 9? 9's the schedule? Okay, so we're going to start a little bit in We Agnostics, and then we'll shoot into step 3 early in the morning tomorrow, which should be a good deal to start in the morning, step 3. And then tomorrow we will try to go through the process. Right now, really we're defining the problem and we're going to start talking about the solution. And then from step 3 on is the blow-by-blow specific directions on how to implement that solution. Very important stuff. Page 44, We Agnostics. In the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If you're an alcoholic of the type that it talks about in this book, you're screwed. You're beyond human aid. You're not a problem drinker. Your powerlessness extends way beyond the bottle. It extends into an emptiness inside you that drives you so crazy you'll come back to drinking in spite of overwhelming information that it's a bad idea. And you will not be able to stop that process. You are absolutely powerless over that. And the best you'll ever do is to stay in a state of abstinence if you can line your life up in such a way to have pretty much regular events of gratification. That's your best hope. Just go from one gratification event to the next. And just one to the next. Just, okay, and that's me again. What am I going to do? Oh, okay. And then there's me again. And oh, and a new car. And then I got the payments. And oh, a new relationship. And that's not it. And that's the best I have to look forward to if I'm a real alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. To one who feels he is an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. Oh, it did. It seemed impossible. I'd gone too far. I'd hurt too many people. God, even if there is a God, He ain't available to me. One of my dear friends was over in Florence last year. Jim, who's sober 41 years, he's a great guy, great friend. And he told me a story that brought tears to my eyes. And he said he was in Florence and he went into this museum and they had a Donatelli exhibit. Now, Donatelli is one of the great religious sculptors. And Donatelli has a lot of depth to him. And I looked this picture up of this sculpture he was telling me about on the internet. It's amazing. And he said he was walking through looking at all these beautiful sculptures, and he walked into this room and he's looking around and he turned around and there was a statue, a life-size statue of the Mary Magdalene. But it was unlike any depiction of Mary Magdalene he'd ever seen. And he'd only ever seen pictures and depictions of Mary Magdalene with the long flowing robes and the hair, and she looked very beautiful. He said this was not like that. This was a woman that was weathered and etched with pain and desperation and hopelessness. You could look at her face and you could tell she'd been turning nickel and dime tricks in the back alleys of Jerusalem for years. And he said she stood there with an expression on her face and her hand out as if she was saying, "This could be for me. For me?" And I know exactly, and I started weeping as I heard him say that, because it touched the thing in me that came here, that feeling of unworthiness, that it's fine for you good people. God, if there's a God, yes, he would help you. But could this be for me? I'm the guy who stabbed his best friend and he'll never be the same. I'm the guy who dimed guys out to the cops and they went to prison. I'm the guy that did things to my parents who loved me, and the only crime they ever committed was they loved me, and I punished them for it for years. And one of the worst things I ever did to them is I kept getting up on my feet again and giving them hope just to trash their life one more time. And I did that to them so long, so brutally, and they took such an emotional beating that my mother, who's not an alcoholic, ended up on tranquilizers seeing a counselor, and my father slept 15 hours a day. Because he couldn't deal with it. For me? For me? Seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he is an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I am an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And then this next line, I don't know if Bill's trying to be funny, but I think it's the funniest thing he's ever written. He says, to be doomed. I like the word doomed. There's a heaviness about doomed. To be doomed to an alcoholic death. Or to live on a spiritual basis. For us, are not always easy alternatives to face. Now we got door number one. Doomed to an alcoholic death. There can't be a worse way to die, because by the time you're dead, everyone you've ever loved or wanted their approval hates you, and they're glad you're dead. You die in shame and guilt. Your emotions are putting the screws to you, and you've wished you were dead for a long time before you die. I can't imagine a worse way to die. Doomed to an alcoholic death, or to live by spiritual basis, Bill says, and it's true, are not easy alternatives to face. If you were to go to a cancer ward where people have been diagnosed as terminally ill beyond human aid, as my mother was a few years ago, and you were to go to these cancer patients that have no hope, and you'd say, "Man, I'm telling you, we got a deal that has worked for 4 million people just like you. If you'll just live a certain spiritual way of life, you don't have to die of cancer. You, not only that, but you're going to go out and help other people to not die of cancer, and your life is going to be better than it's ever been." They would beg you to tell them what to do, and they'd jump right on it. You go down, as I do, and members of my home group and the guys I sponsor several times a week, to Skid Row places where people are dying of alcoholism. Dying of alcoholism. And you say the same thing to them. Give them the same choice, and they'll go, well, tell me about that alcoholic death again. I mean, how bad can it be, really, you know? I mean, what kind of spiritual basis? I mean, you know, I really don't want to go to those meetings, and I'm not. Nobody's telling me what to do, and I ain't writing nothing. That's bizarre. It's bizarre, but it's true. It's pathetic, but it's true. As I sat there in meetings, and people would lay this simple kit of spiritual tools at my feet, and I kept, because I couldn't believe I was doomed. See, I was not an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I still had the illusion that I'm going to turn the corner. And I, notice the word I, that I am going to beat this thing. I failed. That's why I have a sponsor. That's why I work the steps. Because I am going to kill me. I'm telling you, I am going to kill me. I failed. And so I will pick up every day. I'll pick up this simple kit of spiritual tools. And I hope, I pray to God, I never think I'm so well that I don't need to. Or I will probably end up in the same place that everybody I've ever seen ends up that thinks that and acts accordingly. But it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope. We were not true alcoholics. Oh, I remember that. You know, it's got to just be an emotional problem. It's just, maybe it's just I'll outgrow this. You know, it's really because I don't have the right person to love me. It's really, I'm just not properly financed, and I worry too much about money. If I didn't have to worry about money, I wouldn't feel like this. I wouldn't have to drink. I'd be free.